Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. You can find me at ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com or on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And of course, you can subscribe to Food for Thought at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're enjoying this free podcast, thank you so much for supporting it. You can do so at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau and join the others who are making this podcast possible. This podcast being an award-winning podcast. It won, once again, Best Podcast from Veg News Magazine. So thanks to all of you who voted for it. And I just ask that you share Food for Thought with those who might be interested. And of course, thank you for leaving ratings and reviews on iTunes. Word of mouth is the best way to increase its listenership. Dispersed between and among our regular Food for Thought episodes are special episodes in which I sit down with other animal advocates to talk about what it means to be a voice for those whose voices we need to hear and how to change the world for animals. I've talked a lot about the effects of ranching over the years, an industry that is particularly prevalent here in the West. I'm in California, and one that affects more lives than just the direct victims, the sheep, the cattle, the goats, for instance, who are bred, raised, and ultimately killed for commercial purposes, either for human consumption of their flesh and fluids or for their hair and skin. Ranchers also, of course, raise elk, bison, ostriches, emus, alpacas for the same purpose, commercial use. Obviously, the direct victims of ranching are herd animals who are kept on large tracts of land, primarily in temperate climates, such as in parts of South America, the prairie provinces of Canada, the Australian outback, and the Western United States, where ranching is the primary use of land out here. Ranching, animal agriculture, and its associated cowboy culture have been much romanticized over the centuries, when in reality, it's far from romantic for the animals who are herded, rounded up, ear-tagged, castrated, branded, impregnated, sheared, driven, that is, moving a large herd from one place to another, transported, and ultimately slaughtered. It's also far from romantic for the victims of rodeos, a cruel form of entertainment that grew out of the ranching industry, and which boasts such events as calf roping and calf tying, steer wrestling, bull riding and goat tying, saddle bronc riding, and bareback bronc riding, the latter of which involve bucking straps, spurs, and prods. It's also far from romantic for the wild land that has been decimated, the wild grasses that have been diminished, the soil that's been eroded, the rainforests that have been cleared, the biodiversity that's been destroyed, the desertification that has been created, the global warming that's been triggered from the methane and the carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases from animal waste, and of course, for the wild animals who are constantly under assault, especially the free-roaming animals who have been demonized by the ranching industry for centuries, the predators. And that's what we're going to talk about today. That's who we're going to talk about today. And for that, we have a very special guest. I've known of Camilla Fox and her incredible work for many years, but it wasn't until this past year that we finally connected in person. It was at the Animal Law Symposium down in Los Angeles, organized by Animal Legal Defense Fund. And if you want to know more about animal law, I encourage you to listen to the episode I did with ALDF Executive Director Stephen Wells, ALDF, Animal Legal Defense Fund. Camilla gave a wonderful and important presentation on coexisting with wildlife and the challenges predators face. And she started off with a very short video called How Wolves Change Rivers. I talked about this briefly in a previous podcast episode when I recommended George Monbiot's book called Feral, Rewilding the Land, the Sea, and Human Life. Hit pause right now, if you're able to, before listening to my chat with Camilla, and go to youtube.com, search for How Wolves Change Rivers. It's based on Monbiot's TED Talk on rewilding, and I believe he narrates that short video, and the video is also on my website on the page for today's episode. If you can't watch it at this moment before our conversation, I urge you to watch it as soon as you're able. It's just 4 minutes long, and I think it's a good introduction to one of the reasons we need to save predators, and why I value Camilla's work so much. Camilla and I became fast friends. She lives just in Marin County, which is just north of me here. I'm in Oakland. And I've been a great admirer of her and her work at Project Coyote. She's the founder of Project Coyote, an organization based in Northern California. It's a coalition of scientists, educators, ranchers, and citizen leaders promoting compassionate conservation and coexistence between people and wildlife through education, through science, and through advocacy. They work to change laws and policies to protect native carnivores from abuse and mismanagement. They advocate coexistence instead of killing. They seek to change negative attitudes toward coyotes, wolves, and other misunderstood predators by replacing ignorance and fear with understanding, respect, and appreciation. And we're going to talk all about their amazing work today. So I've mentioned to you before, I'm very jealous that your last name is Fox. I decided I'm going to change my name. I don't know, maybe to deer or stag or something like that. But was it a given that you'd become an animal advocate with a name like Fox?
Well, I will share that my father actually studied wild and domestic canids growing up, wolves and foxes and dogs and wild dholes in India. So from a very young age, I was surrounded by animals, not just canids, but also cats and rescued animals. So I knew from a very young age that I wanted to spend my life protecting animals and the environment. And so Fox came with it, and it's my real name.
I know. God, that's amazing. And maybe he's the one who changed his name to fit with his career. I was a wee animal advocate in the early 1990s when I heard of your father. I knew the work that he was doing. So it sounded like he did influence you in terms of how much you were surrounded by animals and animal behaviorists and you know, just notions of animals and animals themselves. So it sounds like that did influence you in terms of you pursuing this as a career yourself.
Most definitely. And to give credit to my mother as well, she was a cat rescuer in Maine, Freeport, Maine, where I grew up. And so just from a very young age, we were always rescuing animals and caring for them. So I give a lot of credit to my parents for instilling in me an appreciation for other sentient beings and a great deal of empathy and compassion for the beings with whom we share our lives, both domestic and wild. And I'm just grateful to be able to pursue my passion. It's a calling, which is always a blessing and a curse, but I'm grateful to be able to, you know, dedicate my life to this.
Yeah, that is incredible. I know one thing that a lot of advocates struggle with is they have such an affinity for animals. They have an affinity for animal advocacy. They want to do something to help. And they feel that really, if they're not doing it as a career, that they're not being effective. But there are so many different ways people can be influenced, certainly by our family, by our parents. Most of us are raised in an environment where we're encouraged to be compassionate, where we're encouraged to appreciate nature. At least there was a time. We'll talk about that today in our conversation. But it's not that you have to become, you know, make this a career, because for some of us, you know, it's not a calling, or for some of us, it's not even possible. But I think what's exciting and what I love about the work you're doing is that there are so many opportunities to be an ambassador for animals, and you don't have to necessarily make a career out of it to be effective.
Absolutely. And I will share that most of the people involved with us across the country are volunteers. And many of these people put in, you know, hours a week helping our cause, and everything from reaching out to their community about what it means to coexist with wild animals, from coyotes to bears, raccoons, mountain lions, to helping write letters to the editor, getting involved with state wildlife agency campaigns where they go and testify. So there are a whole variety of ways that people can get involved in their free time. And so, yes, you don't have to be doing this full time to give back to the animals.
Yeah, and those are no small things. I mean, every time we're a voice for animals, we're really changing the way people think about them and treat them, and certainly policies that affect them greatly, and especially wildlife. You know, I mean, I talk a lot about urban wildlife, because I'm here in Oakland, of course, you know, everyone has wildlife around them, even if they're in the smallest space. And if they're in an apartment building, they still have wildlife around them. And it's so interesting. I mean, you talk a lot about coexisting with wildlife, and I'm so excited to share this with our listeners today, because when we talk about animals, not us, when I say we, I don't necessarily mean you and I and maybe people listening, but there's often rhetoric that talks about animals, especially in our cities, as if they're outsiders, as if they're intruders, when really, and language matters so much, the way I like to talk about them, as they're members of our communities, they're residents, they're contributors. And it is really amazing to me that no animal seems to escape criticism or hostility, but certainly some are more demonized than others. We malign the herbivores like deer for eating our plants. We malign the carnivores for being who they are. Wolves are certainly maligned in more rural areas. But an animal who's been on the receiving end of disdain, who lives in both rural and urban locales, is the coyote. And I'd love to talk about the coyote in general and why you chose to focus on coyotes as the ambassador for the work you do at Project Coyote.
Absolutely. And we do get asked that question of why did we choose the coyote as our icon or flagship animal when our work is also to protect the more sexy, charismatic megafauna, if you will, the wolves, mountain lions, and bears. And my response to that is threefold. One, the coyote is by far the most persecuted native carnivore in North America. We estimate that every year at least 500,000 coyotes are killed in the U.S. alone, and that averages about one per minute. And we do believe that if we can shift the way we view and treat coyotes, we can shift the way we view and treat other predators because they have been maligned for so long. Another reason is they are unique to North America. Unlike wolves and foxes who inhabit other continents, the coyote is only lives on the North American continent. They evolved back in the Pleistocene on this continent, and so they have millions of years of coevolution with other wild animals and with us. And so because of that, many of the Native American tribes across the continent have stories about coyotes, reverence for this animal, the animal that was considered the trickster, the ancestor, their brother. And so that quality of appreciation and respect by Native American tribes is another reason we felt that this was an appropriate icon for the organization. So for all of those reasons, and another reason I'll mention too, the similarity between coyotes and our domestic dogs is so close that the two species can actually interbreed. Now, we don't see a lot of that interbreeding, but it's possible because they are so genetically close. And one of the things we're trying to show is that we love our domestic dogs. We spend millions of dollars on them every year while we vilify their wild cousin, the coyote. And we're trying to show those parallels, that there's something very, very wrong with that, that we exploit the coyote in so many horrific ways, which I know we're going to talk about, and yet we love and appreciate their domestic cousin, the domestic dog. So we are trying to shift that and to really foster respect and appreciation for our American song dog, the coyote.
I love that. I mean, it's like you're the best PR team for the coyote. I mean, that's really what these animals need, is really PR, because they've been so vilified, and so much of it is just based on fear. And most of that fear comes from a misunderstanding of who they are. So being able to just tell their stories and talk about who they are and what it means when you see them is so important. So tell us, I mean, so when someone sees a coyote in a local park, in their backyard, what is the first thing you would want people to think, or how would you want them to react?
Well, certainly, and you mentioned fear. I mean, unfortunately, fear is often the first response, and I think there's a whole host of reasons for that. I think, you know, first and foremost, we were once prey on the Serengeti, so we have a visceral, understandable fear of predators. But that said, there's a risk perception, and there's an unfortunate fear mongering that has happened in the media, even in storybooks, stories that we were raised with, fearing the big bad wolf, the mountain lion, the coyote, as something that poses a danger to us, when in fact the risk is very infinitesimal. So I think it's important for people to understand that risk, perception, and the fact that your chances of being injured by a cow, a deer, the neighborhood dog, even a flying champagne cork is greater than being injured by a coyote. So the first thing we would want people to think about is really sort of checking in with their own response and their own behavior, and to recognize that most coyotes want to have nothing to do with that with us. That said, like domestic dogs, coyotes are very instinctually curious. So they may stop and check us out, and especially if we're walking a dog, there's curiosity there, natural curiosity. We frequently get inquiries of or claims that coyotes are stalking me, stalking my family. And in fact, when we actually look at those behaviors from video or you know, other ways that people have shared the experience of perceiving that the animal is stalking them, it's in fact curious behavior. So again, just seeing that coyote, analyzing the situation, and we have so much information on coyote ecology and behavior and understanding what's going on. Like I said, most of the time, coyotes want to have really nothing to do with us. And I will also say that if there are situations where there's a coyote that perhaps is habituated, meaning that they've lost their natural wariness of us, which may happen as a result of intentional or unintentional feeding, for example, there are ways that we can scare that coyote out of there, out of the area. And we call this coyote hazing or aversive conditioning. And we have a whole field guide to coyote hazing on our website. And again, these are situations where if we feel that the interaction with the coyote doesn't feel safe, that's when one would employ hazing. Most of the time, and I would say 9 times out of 10, the coyote is going to exit that situation, or it's not going to be something where hazing is necessary. But if one is feeling like it's an uncomfortable situation, that the coyote is too close for comfort, then they can employ these hazing techniques.
Hazing techniques like making loud noises, just discouraging them from being around.
Exactly. So it's generally being big, bad, and loud. And there are different ways of doing this. Different tools that one can carry, whistles, umbrellas that can pop up umbrellas. And these are for, you know, if there are situations where there is a habituated coyote, people are seeing them on a regular basis, they're feeling like, you know, their regular walk with their dog feels uncomfortable and they want to empower themselves with a tool to scare that coyote away, there are these various things that they can carry. But again, I want to emphasize that most of the time, the coyotes are just, you know, sharing our habitat and they're our wild neighbors. And if we can generally shift our behaviors, we can peacefully coexist safely with them.
And it may also be that it's a female. Could it possibly be also if they're staying close, there could be a litter that they would have just had? What times of year, Camilla, would that be the case?
Yeah, so coyotes, they give birth in April, and they're generally, so right now we are entering coyote breeding season when they will be looking for mates. They've just dispersed, the young have dispersed from their natal dens, and some of them are now looking for new mates and territory. And then in February, they will, that's their breeding time. And then there's a 63-day gestation period. So generally the time that they're giving birth is around April. And then from about April through August, the family is raising the young, and both the mother and father participate in rearing and provisioning the young. And this is the time really when, particularly after about 7 weeks, so into May, when the coyotes are just starting, the little pups are starting to enter out of the den. This is a time when the parents are a little bit more protective of their den site areas. And so it's a time when we recommend that people think a little bit more consciously about walking their dogs on leash in open space areas where coyotes might be denning. Because we do see that when there are encounters in this time, April through August or September, often it's off-leash dogs that pursue the coyotes or get into their den site area and basically threaten the family. And so this is when we do see sometimes an uptick in conflicts. So again, during that period, we recommend that people avoid den site areas. But if they are recreating in green space, open space areas where coyotes are known to live, to walk their dogs on leashes and be a bit more mindful of the fact that we do share these areas with wild animals.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what this is changing the lens through which we see them. So to understand, to recognize that they are sharing, we're sharing their space, they're sharing our space. This is what it looks like to coexist. So that's dogs. What about cats? Because, you know, there's, of course, people who talk about coyotes coming and taking their cats, which is probably the case because they're just they're natural predators. And often these are human issues because people just have their cats roaming freely. So do you have any words of wisdom around cats and coyotes?
Well, I think you just nailed it. I mean, essentially, the reality is once we let our cats outside, they become part of the ecosystem. And what that can mean is that when a coyote is looking at a bunny rabbit or a cat, they don't differentiate. It's a potential easy meal. So for all the reasons that the outdoors can be dangerous for cats, from roads to domestic dogs to coyotes, even raptors, we encourage people to keep their cats inside. Cats can also take a heavy toll on songbird populations. So for all those reasons, we do encourage people to keep their cats inside and to supervise their domestic animals. And that means, you know, whether that's dogs, cats, or even domestic livestock, growing increasing number of hobby farms, even in urban, suburban areas. And so, you know, chickens and other animals can become prey to predators. And it's our responsibility as guardians to protect our domestic animals.
Yeah, it's really funny. As you know, I let Charlie and Michiko have supervised time outside when I'm with them. And people see photos of me with them outside and they say, how do you keep your cats close to you? And I say, I don't ever hear parenting. I mean, like, I keep them close to me. Like, that's what I do. And just like if you had a child, a human child, you know, you draw boundaries, and cats can recognize boundaries. So there's, you know, there's even a way to do it so that you can keep them safe. I never let them out with me again past 4 o'clock. I don't care what time of year it is. They're inside with me. I would never let them out at night because, of course, for the natural predators, that is a time when they're hunting, especially. Would that be true of coyotes as well? Are they strictly nocturnal?
They're not strictly nocturnal. They will forage and be out during the day. But I would say they're what we call crepuscular, which means that they're most active during dawn and dusk. And that's when they're often out looking for their natural prey, which generally are rodents and insects and even fruit. So if we're trying to avoid them, those are times to think about perhaps walking at a different time if you're seeing them out at that dawn and dusk and you're concerned. But you make a really good point, Colleen, about supervising our animals. So, you know, I know lots of people who have a similar regime with their cats. And I think supervision is the key. You know, we supervise our two-leggeds, and that's just a given that we know that, you know, we don't let our 2-year-old or 3-year-old children out unsupervised. The same goes for our domestic animals. And so I think that message is really critical. I'll also mention that there's a growing demand for catios, and catios are, you know, essentially habitats for cats that you can build. And there's all sorts of neat designs out there that allow them to be outside in an enclosure and protected from coyotes and other predators.
Yeah, there's lots of options out there. And just to stay with that, for the protection of our companion animals, but also so that people don't have fear around seeing a coyote during the day. So if they do see a coyote during the day, or I have this experience, we don't have coyotes where we are, but we have foxes. And I know that it's not uncommon to see them during the day, but the people have this notion that if they see any predator, any wild animal, even raccoons, and sometimes it can be the case that they're not well, that there's something wrong, that there's that it's abnormal. So if they see a coyote during the day, not necessarily. I mean, this to me goes back to people being able to document what they're seeing in their environment around them, whether they're in homes, they have yards, whether they have a lot of space, or they're in an apartment. Is we can be their documentarians, where we can actually watch and note if we see any abnormal behavior, and so that we can become familiar with the rhythms of the animals who we share the space with, so that if they see a coyote during the day, you know, maybe once, it's not a big deal. If they see them maybe several times, again, just kind of noting the behavior, but it's not necessarily abnormal if they see any of these animals during the day.
No, absolutely not. I you just mentioned foxes and other animals like raccoons, that perfectly normal to see them during the day. But there is a general fear out there and mistruth that seeing a coyote or a fox during the day means that they must be sick or have rabies or some other disease, which is in fact not the truth. And particularly in California, we have not seen rabies in coyotes, I think, for over 30 years now. So coyotes are not generally sick with rabies if seen during the day. That said, I will say that sometimes coyotes and foxes can succumb to mange, which is a pretty horrible disease to have. For anyone who's seen a dog with mange, it's very horrible and quite painful for them. So that is a disease that sometimes we do see in canines, and generally the way it will be seen in a coyote or a fox is they have lost a lot of hair. They might have scabs. And so that is treatable, actually. So we encourage, if people do see that, to contact their local humane society and or wildlife rehabilitation center if they have one, because that is a treatable disease.
Yeah, and I would really recommend, I've said this a number of times on the podcast, I'd really recommend people getting familiar with their wildlife experts in the area, wild care experts, people who will rehabilitate and treat and certainly release a wild animal when it's possible. So we're so lucky to have so many wonderful wild care, including wild care organizations near us. So it's really wonderful for people to have that information and keep them in your phone, keep the number in your phone and use them as resources, because I think people are so inclined to call, say, animal control if they see anything that might seem out of the ordinary, or frankly, anything that might even be ordinary, but they're not paying attention. So they think it's strange to see, for instance, a raccoon during the day. So get to know the wild care specialists and ask them questions. Use them as a resource. Use your website as a resource, projectcoyote.org, so that we can become more informed, because so many of the problems that wildlife encounter, it's because of our misunderstanding and about them, about who they are.
Well said, Colleen. And I think that is so, so true when it comes to wild animals, is the lack of awareness and just basic information, I think, leads to the fear-based reaction that we have to the presence of wild animals. And what even scientific surveys show is that when people are informed even a little bit about wildlife ecology and behavior, that empowers them to feel less fearful and to recognize, you know, a situation that, if they don't have that information, may seem like a threatening or dangerous situation, when in fact it's just an animal doing its own thing. And so that is the reason why, for Project Coyote, we believe that education is so fundamental. And it's also why we provide a whole host of free resources on our website, so that people, individuals, and communities can download that information and become better informed.
It is. It's so important. I've told the story in this podcast about, many stories about wildlife, but one in particular, when I was in Florida, there were two young girls on the sidewalk laughing at something they were looking at in someone's yard. And it was a raccoon who appeared to be jocular. But he was so clearly in distress, and they were laughing. And when I asked them what they were looking at, they pointed to this raccoon, and the woman in the house was cowering in her house, and she had been there all morning because this raccoon was in her yard in clear distress. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Have you called wild?" And she said, "We called wild. We called animal control. They never came." And I said, "Well," so I went to my phone. I'm not even from the area. I looked up wild care, you know, wildlife rehab, whatever I searched for, and found a place nearby and called them. And then I said, "Do you have any gloves?" And they said, "You don't want to touch the raccoon." I said, "If you have gloves and a box, he's clearly in distress." And it turned out he had distemper, which was so sad because it's a terrible, terrible way to suffer and die. And I brought him to the wildlife place, and they did wind up euthanizing him, but I was really happy to at least alleviate his suffering. The point is, they were so scared of this animal who was clearly in distress, who wasn't going to, I mean, he wasn't a threat to them, you know, per se, but of course, you know, I handled it in the way that I thought was safe for me and for him as well. But he was just so sad. And so just that fear of just not understanding that that they're not demons. I mean, they were acting like he was like some demon from the abyss, and he was just a raccoon who had distemper. And so much of it is just kind of our misunderstanding about what their situations are and how we can intervene, because there are so many compassionate ways we can intervene without causing harm to ourselves or to our children or to our animals. I told you about the buck here in my neighborhood who broke his knee several years ago. I am sad that I haven't seen him since. His name was Marcus. And on the neighborhood listserv, someone said, "Oh my God, I see this buck in my yard, and I'm so scared for my child and my dog because he looks injured." And I said, "Yeah, that's Marcus. He just has a broken, you know, leg. It's swollen. He's okay, but he's not going to hurt you. Like, he's more afraid of you than you are of him." So much of it is just kind of calming that down and then kind of operating from a logical, compassionate place.
Absolutely. And I think too, the fact that people feel fearful and also not sure how to react. And there's several levels here. So one area is that we're looking at increasingly is this disconnect from nature. And there's a term for it. It's called nature deficit disorder. And it's a recognized condition, if you will, particularly for young people now, that is emanating from a culture that is more urban based and more separated from wildlife, from nature. And the manifestations can be, among other things, a base fear of anything other, anything wild, anything nature. And we think that's very concerning, because that disconnect can manifest with this fear-based reaction to the presence of wild animals. And then more importantly, it's a disconnect that creates a feeling that that other is not something that we need to care for. Mm-hmm. And we can't care for something that we don't know or love or appreciate. So part of what we're trying to do as an organization is to reconnect people with nature. And we have a program called Keeping It Wild, which is all about getting youth and educators reconnected with nature and through coyotes and other apex North American predators, reconnecting us to their importance in maintaining healthy ecosystems, getting kids involved in conservation, getting them out into the wild so that, for example, in our urban areas, we can go wildlife tracking. We can look for coyote paw prints and scat, and we can learn about their ecology and why they matter, how they help to, for example, control rodent populations so that we don't need to use deadly rodenticides. So I think all of that is so interconnected. And your story from Florida and this cowering woman, you know, had she had some information about wildlife and about, you know, their normal behaviors, perhaps she wouldn't have been so fearful. And if she knew that, you know, there's a local rehab facility that she could call and get some assistance. So all that is so pivotal. And it's, again, it comes back to the need for more education, just basic education. And that's why we have people all over this country doing presentations to their communities. We just yesterday, we sent out an e-blast for Giving Tuesday, and we included links there for people to access template letters to the editor, template postings for Nextdoor. anyone who's been on their next door has probably seen postings about coyotes. We're trying to provide the information so that people can empower themselves to go and post information about how we can better coexist with these animals, links and tools and information about mitigating negative encounters, about basic coyote ecology and biology. So all of that is, you know, things that people can do on their own. And that's why on our website, you know, we try to provide all this information for free so it's accessible to a wide audience.
I can't overemphasize enough. I encourage everyone to go visit projectcoyote.org, and I really encourage everyone to follow you on social media. I am so impressed with your social media posts. I don't know who's responsible for that, but thank them because they're so informative. They're just chock full of information, inspiration, education, and I learn so much every time I see a post on Twitter. It's mostly Twitter that I'm watching, and I'm so impressed with it. So I really encourage people to check out projectcoyote.org for resources there on the website, and of course events, live events around the country where they can learn more and be part of educating. I mean, just knowing the language to be able to communicate with people, because when I calmed those women down in both the situations, they were both grateful, and you could see that they had had a real shift. And now I don't know what that means for the future for them, but it was just, I was really happy to be there as the person saying, this is what it looks like. And I didn't judge them. I went back the next day with information to the woman with the raccoon and gave them information so that doesn't have to happen again. And I think it was just really good for them to see someone intervening in a way that this was all just normal. This was all okay, that there were nothing bad happened. And it really is education. And I'm so grateful to you for doing that. And so, of course, we're talking about educating the public. We're talking about educating people in their homes, where they live. But there's other components of this education as well. A lot of people aren't familiar with the fact, I mean, some people are, but not a lot of people know about the program whereby our tax dollars pay for the trapping and snaring and poisoning of wild animals at the behest of ranchers. Can you talk about maybe talk about the government first and kind of what people might not be aware of in their own communities? Certainly, it's something that we see a lot here in the West because there's so much ranching that happens in the Western United States, but really just locally that people might not be aware of in their own communities that where they might be able to intervene as well, or just at least letting people know that they can contact their government officials about things they might not be comfortable with.
Yeah, so I think you touched on the agency that that is behind a lot of the predator control in the United States. Most people have never heard of this agency. It's called the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Program, and it is a program that has been in existence since 1931, which was passage of the Animal Damage Control Act. That act essentially codified the federal government's involvement in predator eradication. And eradication was actually the terminology used back in the 30s. And the goal of this agency back then it was known as the Bureau of Biological Survey, the goal was to exterminate predators in the United States, largely at the behest of ranchers. And so wolves, coyotes, bears, mountain lions were viewed as a threat to both livestock and to the prey that humans were hunting for game. So eradication was the goal, and the way it was implemented was with a variety of lethal and largely indiscriminate tools, including leg hold traps, snares, a little later on in the 40s and 50s, poisons, now in the last 30, 40 years, aerial gunning, so shooting these animals from low-flying aircraft, often prophylactically, meaning that they go out in the spring before lambing season and they kill any of the predators that they can target, often on our public lands, so Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands. And so, unfortunately, even though the science over the last 50 years has shown that predators are vital to healthy ecosystems, this government continues this predator eradication program. And how it functions is basically at a county level. So the county contracts with this USDA Wildlife Services agency And often the county will put in 50% of the funds, and then that's matched by the federal government. So it's incentivized for counties to contract with this agency. And with that money goes to pay a federal trapper whose job it is to go out and trap and kill and poison our native wild animals. This includes coyotes, bobcats, foxes, mountain lions, bears, wolves, skunks, badgers, raccoons. That's just the tip of the iceberg for the animals that are targeted by this agency. And again, it's largely done at the behest of ranchers and agribusiness. And you and I, as taxpayers, we subsidize this agency to the tune of over $100 million every year. And that doesn't include the county portion of it. That's basically the federal contribution. So most people are completely unaware of this program. When I give presentations across the country, I ask people if they've ever heard of USDA Wildlife Services. Most audiences, there are no hands that go up, maybe a couple. People have heard of Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's the agency that oversees, among other things, protection of threatened and endangered species. But USDA Wildlife Services is almost on the opposite spectrum, where they're largely about in the killing business and killing those animals deemed a threat to agriculture. So for Project Coyote, we have been working to reform predator management in the United States. We have helped to form coalitions around this, both national coalitions and statewide coalitions. We firmly believe as an organization that the only way we're going to reform predator management and our relationship with wild animals is through the formation of these coalitions, bringing together animal protectionists, conservationists, and even other interest groups, taxpayer interest groups, Native Americans, to look at how we can shift the way that we have historically treated wild animals, and in particular, the apex predators on this planet. That's why the focus of Project Coyote is on our North American apex predators. We believe that they are vital for healthy ecosystems. We know that through science now. We also know that, in general, most people appreciate wild animals. We like to point out that there was global outrage when Cecil the lion that was in Zimbabwe, who was killed by a trophy hunter, a dentist from Minnesota, with a $50,000 price tag on his head. That killing elicited global outrage. And yet, we point out that in our own backyard, we are killing our own wild felines and canines, our mountain lions, our bobcats, wolves, coyotes, foxes. They're both trophy hunted and trapped. Many of them are trapped for the international fur trade, and then they're killed by this federal agency when they come into conflict with livestock. But I mentioned even that we don't even have to have conflict and verified conflict before many of these animals are killed. So they're frequently killed by our governments prophylactically before any conflict has occurred. And I will mention that reflects the lack of protections by our state governments for these species. So, for example, coyotes and foxes and many other species have virtually no protections by our state wildlife agencies. They're frequently classified as non-game or even nuisance classification, which essentially means they have no protections and they can be killed with almost any method imaginable. And that translates to a lot of cruelty, a tremendous amount of cruelty. I think you know, Colleen, we've taken on the issue of predator killing contests. This is just another form of the horrific ways that we treat these animals. So just to give a little background, predator killing contests, and it's not just predators, it's other wild animals that are targeted in these killing contests, including prairie dogs, rattlesnakes, foxes, bobcats, coyotes, even wolves over the last 2 years in Idaho when they were delisted, removed from the endangered species list. And this is a practice where hunters get together, and I don't even want to call them hunters. They're basically people who enjoy killing animals gratuitously for prizes and inducements. And they will often get together on the weekends and have these killing contests where they go out and whoever kills the most or the largest of a given species win a trophy or a belt buckle or a rifle. And these are going on all across the U.S. Again, another question I ask when I give talks, how many people have ever heard of wildlife killing contests? Few hands go up. Most people are absolutely shocked to hear this is going on virtually every weekend from about now, so November through February and March. These killing contests take place across the U.S. I will say that we were able to largely close the loop on these killing contests targeting predators in California. So it's now illegal to kill fur-bearing or non-game animals. This includes bobcats, foxes, coyotes, raccoons, for any kind of prize or inducement in California. And we led that effort, Project Coyote led that effort with a coalition several years ago, and we petitioned our California Fish and Game Commission to close the loopholes on this practice. I will also share that many of our commissioners had no idea that this was going on in California, which reflects the fact that most of these species have no protections whatsoever, so they're not even monitored by our state wildlife agencies that ostensibly have the oversight over all of these various animals. But we pointed out they have no oversight because there's no protections for them, so there's no one monitoring them, so they are being killed in these horrific killing contests. And we are hopeful, though, that like dogfighting and cockfighting, which we have banned across the U.S. now, that we can bring an end to these wildlife killing contests. Because we know when people hear about them, they're outraged. We know that if we gave this issue to the voters to decide whether they should be legal or illegal, that they would ban them. And we know that because virtually every wildlife-related ballot measure that's been put on a state ballot has been passed. Banning trapping, spring bear hunting, for example, any kind of wildlife protection measure, generally the American populace has been behind. So one of our focuses as an organization is to raise public awareness about these wildlife killing contests and then to enact legislative bans. So we've just finished a film focused on this issue. It's called Killing Games, Wildlife in the Crosshairs. And we've just been selected by the Wild and Scenic Film Festival to have our global premiere there in January of 2018, which we're really excited about. And our hope is to get this seen far and wide. We've just formed a national coalition aimed at banning wildlife killing contests that includes multiple national and statewide organizations. And we are working together as a coalition to both raise awareness about the issue and then to work on bans.
Amazing. So people can support you because of the work you're doing to stop it. And they can also find out from you where it's happening around the country so that they can reach out to their own officials. Is it something that people can do on an individual basis as well?
Absolutely. And first and foremost, we encourage people to contact their own state legislators and write to them, meet with them. A lot of people don't realize that they actually have a voice and that they can request a meeting with their state legislator. They can meet with their state wildlife agency commissioners and express their disdain with these killing contests. First and foremost, they can learn more about it by visiting our website and find out where it's legal. They can view the trailer of our new film. Lots of information there, and with our colleagues at the Humane Society of the United States, they too have quite a bit of information on their website. They're part of our coalition to ban this practice. So there's lots of information out there and lots of ways that individuals can get involved to help ban this practice.
Yeah, I emphasize all the time that, you know, it's often that our officials don't necessarily know about the issues that we think about all the time. These are state officials or federal officials or city officials, county, and always, you know, mostly elected, some appointed, but mostly elected, who, you know, they're thinking about a number of different issues related to their constituency. So we as animal advocates are thinking about animal issues all the time, and we presume that other people are as well, especially if, you know, elected officials, and they're not. And it really is often the case that they are hearing from other people about the issues they care about, and in this case, often from animal, you know, from people who want to do these things, who want to hunt or kill, or, you know, all these different ways that they're hurting animals. And if they're not hearing from anybody else but them, that will remain policy. Nothing will ever change. So do not underestimate your voice, and don't underestimate the people who you will be reaching out to, your elected officials. Oftentimes they don't even know about these issues, and you're there in this amazing position as an ambassador for animals and as a way to educate them and help change policy. That's significant.
It's very significant. And that's one of the things that we find, is that a lot of people feel disempowered and feel like they don't have a voice. And yet making that phone call, writing that letter, scheduling a meeting to sit down with your local board of supervisors, your local legislator, to give an example, most of the time we have found that Board of Supervisors aren't even aware of the USDA Wildlife Services program that I mentioned. They're not aware that every year their county, often through the County Department of Ag, is signing a contract with this federal agency to kill local wildlife at the behest of ranchers, and again, at taxpayer expense. So that's why we encourage people to learn more about the agency, find out what's going on in their area, simply by often contacting the local county department of ag, requesting the county contract, and that's available through the public records request, through Freedom of Information Act requests. That's public information that you as a American citizen have access to, and then sitting down with your supervisor and letting them know what's going on. Like I said, most of the time, from our experience, a lot of these supervisors have no idea that this going on, and many of them are concerned about it when they learn about it. So know that you have a voice, and know that there are very simple ways of getting involved if you want to get involved.
And it is so interesting when I think about how much we romanticize animal agriculture. When you think about how people, when they are defending against, you know, veganism, for instance, or people not eating animals, one of the things they point out is all the, you know, the, I don't think they really mean this genuinely, but they start talking about how they don't want, you know, cows and pigs to go extinct. And they start defending these particular animals who are really breeds. We're not talking about wild pigs going extinct. I would love wild pigs to actually thrive. And frankly, domestic pigs, who we've turned into little Frankenstein monsters, can barely stand because of what we've done to their bodies. We've bred all of these animals in such ways that they're just really machines for us. But what we don't think about are all the wild animals who are affected by animal agriculture. And there are so many, certainly the ecosystem itself and the individual animals, and yet we romanticize animal agriculture. It's not by mistake.
Absolutely true. And there, you know, there's so many multiple subsidies that are provided to agriculture and in particular ranchers, from cheap grazing allotments that we subsidize, where ranchers are raising cows on huge tracts of land, public lands, and doing it at a very low cost. It's a practical giveaway of our public lands. And then they receive the predator control services from our federal government. So a lot of people are not aware of this. And it just reflects what the emphasis in our country is, which has been largely subsidizing agriculture. And that so many animals suffer in that process. And we're pointing out how many predators suffer in that process. Mm-hmm.
Is it just ranchers? I mean, you know, we talk about this dichotomy between wildlife and domesticated animals in the case of ranchers, but it's not just animals in the ranching industry who are affected in that wildlife services effects. Can you talk more about that?
Absolutely. So wildlife services, as we've seen a reduction in, for example, sheep production in the U.S., Wildlife Services has tried to expand their market, if you will, to keep them in business. And so we've seen an expansion of their activities doing wildlife control in urban areas. So, for example, just recently there was a situation in San Luis Obispo County where a gray fox was lethally removed in an urban area by wildlife services, and it created a real controversy within the community. People were outraged to learn that this gray fox, who had become known by some of the people in the community, that one neighbor called and complained, and it led to wildlife services coming out and essentially setting a trap and killing that animal. And so this is something that I think is important that people know, is that Wildlife Services is not just acting at the behest of ranchers and agricultural community, but they're increasingly doing lethal wildlife control in urban areas.
So how does So how does that differentiate between animal control kind of locally doing the same thing and Wildlife Services? How do we know when one it would be one or the other?
Well, sometimes our local animal control contracts out to Wildlife Services. So what's important is for people to contact their local county ag department and to request any contracts with Wildlife Services if they want to know, you know, who's benefiting from this agency. And it's not, I should say, too, that there are often outfits that will do non-lethal removal. So, for example, let's say with that gray fox, had someone contacted the local animal shelter or wildlife rehabilitation facility, many of those are starting to have businesses that do non-lethal wildlife control. So, for example, here in Marin County and also Sonoma County, both of our wildlife rehabilitation facilities have businesses that do non-lethal wildlife control. So if there's a problem fox or raccoon or skunk, people can call them and receive their services and know that the animals are not going to be killed and know that it will be dealt with, the situation will be dealt with humanely. Now, I will also say with the situation with Wildlife Services in San Luis Obispo County, the people were told that the fox would be relocated. Mm-hmm. So they were under the impression that the animal would be cage trapped and then relocated and released in the wild. That's simply not true. And it's also illegal in many states, including California, for trapped animals to be relocated. They have to be either released on site or euthanized or killed on site. So there's a lot of misinformation as well that sometimes different agencies, including Wildlife Services, misinform the public.
Well, and it goes back to what we touched on a little bit earlier. I mean, I really think that people are compassionate, that they're not looking, that they really think that when their animal, the animal's being driven away, that they're just going to be relocated. They want to believe that. They're not necessarily calling because they want them killed. They're calling because they're concerned for all the reasons we talked about before. But again, education is so important. And it also goes without saying that, or I guess it doesn't go without saying because I'm saying it, is that they actually do care, that a lot of people don't want these animals killed. They think even if they're raccoons they have in their yard that they consider a nuisance, or even rats that they consider a nuisance, if they have someone say, no, we're just going to relocate them, they really don't know that they're often, most of the time, being euthanized.
Yes, I think it's a huge problem. And I do think that there is a misunderstanding often that the animals that are trapped by even, let's say, critter control or pest control firms, that when someone calls to have an animal issue addressed, that they think, and even are frequently misinformed, that that animal is going to be taken off and released into the wild. So people need to recognize that that's most often not the case, whether with Wildlife Services or with calling a pest control firm, and that they should look for a local business that does do non-lethal and request that, because it's consumer demand that's going to increase the number of those options. And that's why we've seen a growing number of those across the country, particularly with wildlife rehabilitation facilities that are starting to offer these non-lethal animal management services.
Yeah, it's about relationship building. It's about relationship building and communication. It so often goes back to that. And I didn't mean for this to be a segue, but it's a perfect segue around communication and language. You know, I talk a lot about language and the words we use, how much those words convey our attitudes towards other animals. And some words are just so loaded. And I really try and make a point to use language that, again, kind of, you know, that paints animals in a much more positive light than they're often painted. It's hard. Some animals have been so disparaged that even just their names themselves, rats or pigs, in their cases, just their names alone, just rats. Like, if I just mention rats, people immediately cower before I've even, you know, they have this image that comes to mind as soon as you even mention their name. But it's one of the things I really love about Project Coyote as well, is because there's just a consciousness around how to talk about animals. I mean, I even struggle with the word wild animals, because the word wild has become so negative. We talk about wild as being, you know, just unkempt or not tame or not civilized. Are there words in particular that you would, again, you know, have us say or have us think about in terms of the way to characterize free roaming animals in a positive way?
Well, I personally love the word wild, and I think language does get co-opted. I love the wild, and we, you know, we want to reconnect people with the wild. There are terms within the sphere of wildlife conservation that reflect our exploitative attitude towards wild animals. So, for example, even the term management, Project Coyote believes that we should shift away from that term management, because it implies that these animals need to be managed in some capacity, when in fact we believe that the best thing we can do is to leave them alone, particularly predators, because they self-regulate. If we don't exploit their populations, they won't exceed the biological carrying capacity of a given area. That's important to know, especially with coyotes, when we get questioned, you know, well, if we don't manage them, they're going to run amok and take over our cities and our communities. When in fact, the very opposite is true, that if we leave them alone, they self-regulate, they will define their territories and keep out, for example, juveniles who are looking for new mates and new territories. If we've left that stable family group intact, they will keep the population stabilized in the area, and those juveniles will be kept out. And in fact, it's often the juveniles in the predator world that create the conflicts, the juvenile mountain lions or coyotes or wolves that may look for novel prey. So, you know, not managing, letting them do what they do best as wild animals is the best thing that we can do. And we know that scientifically. I will also say that, you know, we're trying to, looking at language, shift from, for example, predator management to instead predator conservation and stewardship to reflect what it is our responsibility is with sharing our planet with wild animals.
Mm, I love that. I love that. And speaking of language, can you talk about the etymology of the word coyote?
Well, coyote is an Aztec word, coyotil, so it goes way back. I will also say that the Latin term for coyote, Canis latrans, literally means barking dog. So they are very appropriately named, and we often get questioned, especially out west, isn't it coyote, not coyote? And the reality is it tends to be a little bit more geographically attuned to the area. So a lot of Westerners and call the coyote coyote. I come from the East Coast, where we call them coyote, but both are correct. And really, you know, like I said, when you look historically, they are our song dog. And when you look at the Native American attributes given to this animal, trickster, ancestor, their deity, it's very interesting to look at the parallels that so many cultures had with this animal and you know, the Aztecs with their coyotil.
We tend to value animals in terms of what we derive from them. And I admit I derive much pleasure and joy from animals, from watching animals. I'm someone who is never still for very long, has a hard time being still. I have a hard time even meditating because I have to be still. I have a hard time not being productive, not working on something. And yet if I see an animal outside, it could be a squirrel, it could be a raccoon, it's often a deer, sometimes foxes we're lucky enough to have, I just stop and time passes and I am not thinking about it. I'm not thinking about my checklist. I'm not thinking about everything I have to do. That alone is valuable enough for me. But of course, there are other reasons. And I want to end on a positive note for these animals. And you talked about the nature deficit disorder and how that affects all of us. I mean, it affects us. I think it affects us in urban areas. If I didn't have that, someone just wrote to me today. I actually put a little video out of one of the deer who came this morning. And she said, I saw your video, and then there was an advertisement for some other newspaper over here, and immediately it started a video of like noise and traffic and cars. And she said, I just immediately started getting anxious, and I went back to your video. And I loved that, because that's exactly what it does for us, is it connects us, it grounds us, it calms us, it being this grand thing called nature. And so I mean, that's where I certainly derive pleasures, but they are contributors. These animals are contributors. And I want to end on a positive note around these apex predators, coyotes. Can you talk about the contribution they make to our world?
Yes, and that's a complex, a whole show could be done on all the different virtues of apex predators to our ecosystems and to our world. But in very simplistic terms, as I mentioned, over the last 40, 50 years, since some of the seminal research with Adolf Murie and Leopold, we know now that apex predators are critical for healthy ecosystems. We know, for example, that just looking at Yellowstone, when wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone in 1995 and 96, the impacts on the whole ecosystem were significant. And that's still being studied. Nature is complex. It's not something that you figure out in a few years. So there are ongoing studies looking at the effects of wolves on the Yellowstone ecosystem. But some of the things that we see, for example, elk were over-browsing much of the Yellowstone area, and the wolves essentially through fear of the wolves, it shifted the presence of where elk browsed within Yellowstone, and they were over-browsing a lot of the lower riparian areas, the areas near its streams. And so the presence of wolves essentially shifted a lot of the areas where elk were browsing up into the higher elevations where the elk would be more safe. And so the impacts of that are multifold on the environment. The riparian areas have come back, more beaver have come back, more songbirds have come back, more aspen and willow. And again, these are complex ecosystem dynamics, so I don't want to simplify this, but I think all the scientists agree that the presence of apex predators has a significant positive impact on the environment through what's called trophic cascades. And these are ecosystem dynamics where the effects of these larger predators on all the different trophic levels below them are significant and important. So what that means is that when we remove all these predators from our ecosystems, we're simplifying them. We're creating less diversity, for example. And because of that, it's one of the reasons why, as an organization, Project Coyote has focused on protection of our North American apex predators, because we know that they're so important. So, for example, the coyote, great controller of rodents. We know that they can take up to 1,500 rodents in a year. So remove one coyote from an area and it can proliferate in a lot more rodents. And then we start seeing people using rodenticide, for example. And rodenticide, as we know in the news, can be deadly to non-target animals. And I'll just mention that we're going to be working with a coalition of organizations to ban rodenticides in California this next year, partially because of their deadly impacts on predators, including coyotes, bobcats, and mountain lions, and raptors. So all of these reasons point to the importance of predators. And even some ranchers have recognized the value that a coyote or a bobcat can have to their ranch, or a fox in helping to control those rodent populations. I'll just mention one other critical ecological service that predators provide is they can help to control mesopredators. Mesopredators are the raccoons, skunks, opossums, foxes. So when you have coyotes in the ecosystem, they help to keep those mesocarnivores in check through primarily competitive exclusion. And what that means is that the song and ground bird populations are often higher and more diverse in the areas where you have coyotes, because those mesocarnivores, those raccoons and skunks and opossums and foxes, can have a deleterious impact on the song and ground bird populations. So simplified, what that means is that when you have the apex predators, which coyotes can be in a lot of urban ecosystems, you have a healthier and more diverse environment. And so for all those reasons, predators are really vital to healthy ecosystems and diverse ecosystems.
That's incredible. It's incredible. But speaking of language, I think we need a better term than trophic cascade. We need something sexier than trophic cascade. Just saying, but I'm not going to come up with it because I'm not a scientist. I love it. That is incredible. And I'm so grateful for your work, Camilla, because everything you're talking about, I know that you have had such an impact on the way people think about, again, predators, wildlife, including the ranchers, and the work you're doing is really hard work. I mean, you talk about these coalitions, and I know some of them are really difficult, and it takes time, and it takes relationship building, and it takes not just talking, but it takes listening. And I know these are all the things that Project Coyote is focused on, and there's so much. I mean, there's just so much. We could go on for another hour, and I'm sure that everyone listening has gotten a sense of how much you're doing. And I'm telling you, Camilla is one of the hardest working animal advocates I know, and I am so grateful for your work. Before we close, can you, again, everyone visit projectcoyote.org for resources, but could you just list three things that you would encourage listeners to do to help wild animals, to help predators, to help coyotes in their area?
Sure. I guess one thing would be to join our e-team, which you can do on our website, to get our action alerts and our newsletters and e-blasts. I mentioned we sent one out yesterday that listed different ways that people can help in their community. So get on our list and we will share more information about that. Another way, I mentioned Nextdoor. A lot of people are on Nextdoor. It's a great platform to be able to share information about living and coexisting with our wild neighbors. They can get links and information from our website. We have a whole plethora of resources there, and those links can be shared through Nextdoor. And then I mentioned meeting with your legislators, your local board of supervisor, also your state legislator. First, informing yourself about the issues you want to share with them. I mentioned wildlife services. I mentioned killing contests. These are just some of the areas that once you're informed, you can meet with your representatives, your members of Congress, your local supervisor, and bring your concerns to their attention. So many of them are pleased to hear from their constituents. And I just want people to know that they have a voice and they can weigh in and they can make a difference. Mm.
Before we close, Camilla, can you tell me what gives you hope?
I would say two areas that give me the most hope. One, working with youth, seeing the enthusiasm that they have, particularly when we reconnect to them with the wild, when they get an opportunity to weigh in on saving animals, on having a voice. We've had youth involved in all of our efforts to protect predators in California. We've brought them out before the Fish and Game Commission, before legislators, and seeing them with impassioned testimony, heartfelt testimony before these change makers, policymakers, is just so heartening, because they're the next generation who are going to protect this planet and all the wild animals. Secondly, all of our volunteers, adults, people who are retired, who are getting involved, who want to find a cause, And a passion. And we're seeing that increasingly in the last year, I think, partially because of politics at a federal level. People are wanting to find a cause. They're wanting to get involved. And that has been so heartening. So those areas, just people wanting to make a difference and seeing that they have a voice, that gives me a lot of hope.
Well, you give me so much hope, and you're giving hope to so many of the animals in the world, and I'm grateful to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with everybody about your work at Project Coyote today, and everyone go over to projectcoyote.org and get involved. Thank you so much, Camilla.
Thank you, Colleen.